Hi, welcome back to the TT Wine Explorer podcast. I'm Tanya Tomaszewska. Today's episode is about an anti-alcohol movement, which seems to be picking up steam both here in Canada and in other parts of the world. You may have noticed that during the last 2 years in particular, there's been increased discussion in the news and health publications about the risks of drinking alcohol and how we shouldn't drink more than 2 alcohol drinks per week. Now, that's a big change from the recommended guidelines of sticking to no more than 2 drinks per day, if you choose to drink alcohol, recommendations which have been around since most of us became of legal age to drink wine. So what's going on here? When I'm talking about the anti-alcohol movement in this episode, I'm not talking about how many of us are reducing or cutting alcohol from our lives as part of conscious consumption, being sober curious, for our own health risk reasons, or if we have an unhealthy relationship with alcohol. What I'm talking about in this episode is a seemingly coordinated effort by certain advocacy groups who claim that there is essentially no safe level of alcohol for us to enjoy. To help me navigate what this all means in the world of wine and liquor policy, I've invited my friend and industry colleague Mark Hicken back on the show to share some of his findings in this area. Mark is based in Vancouver and has been a well-known wine and liquor industry lawyer. With close to 20 years of experience with liquor policy issues, Mark was a liquor policy advisor to the BC government, and in the past has made recommendations as to how to improve our liquor policy and regulations here. Most recently, Mark has published his thoughts about the anti-alcohol movement and how much credence we ought to give to the studies which support the no safe amount position. For more information about Mark and to read blogs series on his site, look for winelaw.ca. And no, Mark is not a doctor, but he's spent hours poring over reports, studies, and the commentary of scientists and doctors around these issues. Now, ultimately, of course, you'll form your own views about what levels of alcohol, if any, are right for you, based on your own circumstances, risk factors, desires, and other lifestyle factors. But I hope that you find my discussion with Mark Hicken today informative and useful as you consider your own path. Okay, let's fly. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the TT Wine Explorer podcast.
Hi, Tanya. Thanks for having me on.
So before we dive into a more detailed discussion about the current public discourse around the risks of alcohol and related health claims, I'd like to set the scene a little bit historically. In terms of how we got here, in terms of the state's involvement in what's on our dining room tables and what we pour in our glasses. Now, during our previous discussions, we talked about when and why prohibition was initiated in Canada and how that was intended to curtail overconsumption and the behavior, unruly behavior of the times. And when prohibition ended about 100 years ago, you know, we were allowed to drink again, albeit subject to really rigid rules and provincial monopolies governing us. So I assume that the rationale for imposing those restrictions and monopolies was to safeguard our health. There has been a relaxation of rules since then, but paternalism still seems to be hanging above us in terms of how we consume alcohol. So in broad terms, you know, are rules and regulations that we have around us today underpinned by health policy, or you know, what's the broad context here?
Well, that's a good question. I think that when the government control systems and the monopolies were set up, the overwhelming policy reason back at that time, which is almost 100 years ago now, was for public safety and public order and health concerns. That was the rationale when outright prohibition ended. And it was thought at the time that if government controlled the liquor industry, that they would minimize those sort of public health, public safety issues. I think over the intervening decades, that rationale really fell to the side. And we discovered in North America, because you have to remember that prohibition is almost a uniquely North American concept, that North Americans weren't really that much different from most people in other places in the world where they didn't have that sort of approach, and that we were perfectly capable of having wine with dinner or having a beer while watching a hockey game without causing public safety or health issues. At least that's the case for the majority of people. I mean, there's always, unfortunately, been a small minority of people who have issues with alcohol. But for the last little while, I think the health and safety policy rationale fell to the side. And what carried on those monopolies particularly is revenue and money. Governments became very used to and somewhat reliant upon the revenue that they got from the wholesale distribution and the retail distribution of alcohol sales.
So that's an excellent segue into one of my next questions about the involvement of the state and taxes and alcohol. So, you know, we often in the past, or people have referred to a sin tax when we talk about extra taxes being applied by government onto tobacco or alcohol. You know, for listeners not familiar with the regime here, maybe it's useful to provide a bit of a 101 on this. So in British Columbia, every sale of alcohol is subject to, you know, let's call it the Crown's share, what the bit that the government takes. So, and goes into the provincial government coffers. So, for example, and for context, if I go and buy a $20 bottle of wine at the BC Liquor Store, for example, you know, how much of that $20 goes to the government? And does it make a difference if the wine is made in British Columbia or comes from France or Argentina? And is it different if I buy beer or vodka?
Well, that's quite a few questions.
I know, sorry.
The first one, most governments actually around the world have some form of specialized taxation of alcohol. So there's always sales taxes on pretty much all goods, but a lot of governments have some sort of form of tax on alcohol, and sometimes it's what's called an excise tax. Sometimes it's in the form of, in Canada, it's what's called liquor markup. So the monopolies that are involved in the distribution of liquor add a big chunk of cost through what's essentially a hidden tax onto all alcohol that's sold. And the amounts vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So, for example, in the United Kingdom, their excise tax on alcohol has historically been relatively low, but it has been increasing quite a bit in the last little while. And just very recently, there's a proposal in the UK to raise their excise taxes on alcohol quite dramatically. But in Canada, we also have variations across the country, and some jurisdictions have higher taxes on alcohol than others. And I'll just call them taxes, even if they're imposed by the monopolies, because they're really, it's money going to government. So it's either a either an explicit tax or a hidden tax. Mm-hmm. In British Columbia, the tax that the monopoly puts on is based on the value of the product for wine and spirits. It's based on volume of the product for beer. So it's a little bit different the way it's applied. In BC, I would argue that the amounts that are imposed on wine and spirits are too high. I think that the percentage taxation, for example, for wine, the base taxation rate by the monopoly is 89% for the first chunk of value for wine. So on a bottle of wine, you gave the example of like a $20 bottle of wine. For $20 and below, generally, you'd be looking at that 89% level. So about half of what you're paying, almost half, depending upon the price of the wine, would be taxed. The odd thing is in BC, it actually should encourage you to drink more expensive wine, because as the price goes up, the tax rate goes down to 27%. So if you're drinking more expensive wine, you're actually paying less percentage tax than if you're drinking cheaper wine. And that's the same for spirits. In other places, in Alberta, for example, the liquor markup, the tax is based on the volume of the product. It's about $3 a bottle, regardless of the price of the bottle. And that's generally how most places in the world apply alcohol taxes is based on volume, not on value, but that's how we do it in BC. And I think your last question was about whether it's different depending upon where the wine comes from. So I'll just use wine as an example. Mm-hmm. But this is a similar system for spirits. For wine, all imported product is subject to that tax amount. So the base level is 89%. And that applies to wine from other countries, and it also applies to wine from other provinces. Mm-hmm. So we treat other provinces as if they're other countries. That's a unique part of the Canadian approach to liquor.
Which we discussed in another episode. So thank you. That, I think, hopefully provides a bit of insight and context for people who may go wine shopping in other jurisdictions and then come back home to BC and wonder why the wines are much more expensive here, seemingly, and also maybe why we have fewer selections from some imports of countries, let alone our own country, because I imagine for producers selling the wine into our particular market, that's a higher barrier for entry because the sticker price for the consumer is going to be higher here because of that higher combined taxes, hidden tax markup, however we're going to call it, extra cost.
Yeah, there are facets of the system which make things very variable depending mm-hmm. upon the value of the wine and how much more in demand it is. Occasionally I have seen rare wines for sale in BC, which are actually quite competitively priced globally. For most wine that's on the shelves, it's going to be considerably more expensive than in other parts of the world, and particularly for lower priced wines.
Right.
They will definitely be more expensive. You quite often double the price. For example, if you went across the border, you could probably buy a bottle of Washington State Chardonnay in a supermarket or Costco or somewhere like that for mm-hmm. less than $10. And that same bottle of wine would probably be $20 or more in British Columbia.
Yeah, so thank you. I think hopefully that goes to answering some questions I often receive about, why is wine comparatively so expensive here? It also ties into another topic I wanted to start chatting about, which is what I'll call the multiple hats worn by government here when it comes to alcohol-related aspects. So, for example, the provincial government has rules around people who make wine, selling wine, buying wine. It also collects taxes or the monopoly through, charged on alcohol when it's sold. The province, through a monopoly, sells the alcohol, and it's also our health authority. So there are lots of hats here. And I have an anecdote which I'd like to use to pose my next question or discussion point. So a couple of years ago in Canada Day, I went for a walk down around Vancouver Harbor, which I like to do in the sunshine and think about our country and the year. And I walked through one of the parklets downtown, and there was a sign, and I think it was up by the Vancouver Coastal Authority, Health Authority, and it was a pictorial of a ranking of number of glasses or wine glasses, which almost had a stratification of risk or seemed to connote risk and basically saying, think before you drink. I don't know if I'd seen a sign like that before around. I've seen other kinds of warnings and health warnings in different places, but it made me think, I go into a grocery store and I don't see same or similar signs about think before you have that third cake, think before you buy the kids 10 more packets of biscuits, think before you drink more of that Coke. I'm not trying to get into any discussion specific about health and risk and forensics on the comparison of dangers of sugar. However, what's going on here? Because I remember chatting with a colleague of ours from France who said, well, actually, sometimes you go and see a warning before you eat a hamburger in France. So, what's going on here? Maybe it's not too simple a question, or am I the only one? Or, there seem to be a multiple different risks, but this is something that seems to be more forefront in, public discourse or maybe on the front of policy change right now.
Yeah, I have seen those signs as well. I guess the first point I would make is I think the content of the signs is actually somewhat misleading. And I think we're probably going to get into some of the reasons mm-hmm. why I think that a little bit later. But I take your point that there is something of a conflict of interest when the government is involved in the liquor distribution business, including the retail liquor business. And then it's also supposed to be regulating the business, and it's also funding and administering the healthcare system. So I think there is an inherent conflict of interest there. My own personal philosophical view is that governments should not be in the liquor business in either the wholesale level or the retail level. I don't think it's a good idea for governments to be involved in areas where that they are regulating. I think if they're going to regulate that business, they should not be actually operating the businesses. But that's a philosophical point, and it's, you know, historically in British Columbia, that's not where we are. But I do think that there's also an issue which you sort of raised with your references to food and soda pop and things like that. We seem to be seeing an increase in what I would say is sort of nanny state type interventions with respect to people's lifestyle behaviors. And the first nanny state intervention, which you could probably may be able to argue and probably could argue more effectively was justified, was in terms of smoking. And the governments took action to severely limit smoking through various means. But the scientific evidence on that particular issue was rather overwhelming. Now, those same sorts of bodies, particularly public health bodies, seem to be moving on to issues for which the scientific evidence is a lot more doubtful or sometimes questionable. Right now, we are seeing, certainly in many places in the world, this push against alcohol consumption. I don't think it will stop there. I think that probably you would end up seeing, if they manage to succeed on alcohol, I think they'll move on to another thing. So yep. it could end up being the next target is potato chips or soda pop or something like that.
Yeah.
But I generally think that those sorts of interventions are questionable when the science is not solid. And I think also people should be presented with reliable scientific evidence and not just sort of advocacy, which is what's happening right now, I think, on the public health side.
So thank you. So let's dive into that point. And so I think there's a lot of confusion right now amongst the public about what we think are new guidelines that have been released in Canada. And so a few years ago, there was a study and a report done by some members or for the Canadian Centre for Substance and Use and Addiction, the CCSA. And until that point, you know, what we had thought our recommended guidelines were that, for example, women, if they're going to choose to drink alcohol, have, you know, up to 2 drinks a day, 10 a week for, you know, moderate consumption. And now apparently that's just 2 per week, if any. So what's going on, you know, in broad terms? I know there's a lot about that report, but is that the report, was that the catalyst for this discussion? And are those really our guidelines now? It seems to me that a lot of people are hanging on to the findings of that or the statements of that report. In order, is that underpinning what I'm seeing on the parklet sign? I know this is a really broad question, but I'm not sure where you want to start with this. So maybe just in terms of what's the status of that study? And, you know, then maybe we can get into the you know, your thoughts on the rationale of the underpinnings of the findings of that study.
Sure. You're right. Those signs that were in the parks did reflect the recommendations that were contained in that study from the CCSA, which did recommend low risk, the reduction of low risk drinking guidelines to 2 drinks per week for everybody, and also contained a lot of language about no amount at all is safe. The first point to make, which I think is important, is that although that study was commissioned by Health Canada, which is a branch of the federal government, it has not been accepted by Health Canada. It was simply a study put together by a group of people that I would argue are somewhat biased in their thinking. They came up with radically different guidelines than the previous ones. Health Canada has not accepted the recommendations, and Health Canada has not changed its low-risk drinking guidelines for Canadians. The guidelines remain exactly the same as they were before. So it's still, for women, 2 drinks per day, 10 drinks per week, and for men, 3 drinks per day.
Right. So
that's one of the things that I think has been unfortunate, because even though the federal government has not changed its guidelines, a lot of lower levels of government, including the health authority that put up that sign in the park, is now using a different set of guidelines, which in fact have no government authority. They're simply the recommendations of a small group of people who I would argue are very ideologically biased against alcohol. So I think what we're seeing in Canada is a sort of creeping authoritarianism with respect to this issue. The media has frequently picked up on those suggested recommendations and reprints them as if they were the federal guidelines when they are not. Mm-hmm. And I've seen even levels of provincial government doing the same thing. So I think it's actually a sort of disturbing situation in Canada right now, because you essentially have a vacuum at the federal level where, mm-hmm. even though they haven't accepted the report and they haven't changed their guidelines, they haven't also really made any statements to that effect. If you look at the website, it still has the old guidelines on.
Yeah.
But they haven't been publicly saying, the guidelines are still the guidelines. We think this report was flawed. And I think that that's what they should have said. They should have said, at a minimum, they should have said, we're reviewing the report and we'll get back to you. I think what they should have said was, this report is flawed, and the ideology and the science behind it are flawed, and we outright reject it. That's what I would have liked them to do, but unfortunately they haven't done that.
Yeah, and so I guess through omission of making any statement whatsoever feeds with the confusion about what the status is of recommendations in our country. So just going into the flawed part of this, and I know you spent a lot of time and brain power analyzing and reading through that report and a lot of other, I think, commentary and other analysis of that report and studies. And you've started a 3-part blog series recently, the anti-alcohol nonsense, you know, and your reasons for, you know, why we might not pay attention to some of the advocates who are claiming that there is no safe level of alcohol consumption. So maybe just going back for context for people about the CCSA report, if we can use that perhaps as the case study as your starting point. So that was penned by Tim Stockwell and some others who we'd call academics. And so, you know, your blog, you have a 3-part series. Part one is, you know, your suggestion is only pay attention to good science. So on that point, can you perhaps just summarize your thinking on this? You know, was there Was there not good science applied in that report? And you know, what are examples of a couple of flaws?
I don't think the science behind the report is good at all. I think it's actually quite fundamentally flawed, especially in terms of the far-reaching conclusions that they make. I think that the basis for the 2 drinks per week recommendation is, I don't think there's any justification for that provided in the report. And I think all of the language that's in there that constantly alludes to there being no safe level of drinking, I think that there's also no scientific basis for those conclusions either. The report was prepared, actually, you mentioned kind of academics. It's actually, it was a mixture of public health people and academics. I don't think it was actually written by Tim Stockwell. He was one of the people that was part of the group. But one of the fundamental flaws behind what they're doing is they are making scientific conclusions and sweeping recommendations that they're then extending to social, on a social level, throughout society, the 2 drinks per week recommendation. They're making those recommendations on the basis of a branch of science, which is called nutritional epidemiology. And the same branch of science is behind stories that you will read about bacon is bad for you, or coffee is bad for you, or, you know, a myriad of other things. The problem with this area of science is that it's very hard to actually construct a valid scientific experiment that you can draw proper scientific conclusions from, because the only way you can study these sorts of effects from lifestyle factors, and particularly from food and drink, is by asking people what they consumed and then trying to link that to health outcomes. This is very hard to do because there's everybody has very varied lifestyles. They consume all kinds of different foods. Their health levels are vastly different. Their genetic background is vastly different. It is exceptionally hard to pinpoint whether or not one particular thing caused a health outcome. Was it all the bacon you were eating? Was it all the beer and wine that you were drinking? Was it the fact that you don't exercise? Was it the fact that you are unfortunately genetically prone to that health outcome? It's extremely hard to do that. And there's been some very prominent good analysis of this. One of the leading people on the sort of analysis of scientific validity down at Stanford said that this is an extremely problematic area and we really should not be making these sorts of conclusions from this branch of science. There's also a great article by a fellow named David Morrison. If you look up his blog, it's called The Wine Gourd, G-O-U-R-D. He has an article about why the World Health Organization has got it wrong on alcohol. And the basic problem is you just can't validly draw those sorts of conclusions from the types of studies that are being done. So you can't say validly, I conclude that there is no safe level of alcohol consumption. The science just does not support that conclusion. And any scientific, supposedly scientific person who makes that conclusion is being dishonest, because you can't do it validly from the science that's being used. So that is a fundamental problem with what's being done. And I think a related fundamental problem is that a lot of times the study, and this I think is true for the CCSA study particularly, they misrepresent in the study. And I can't I can't figure out why they would do it other than by doing it deliberately, is that you find some very tiny risk factor for some particular outcome. So, for example, maybe it's prostate cancer or something. There's a tiny risk factor for that, and in your study, and your study might not even be valid, but in your study, you found an increased in prostate cancer for somebody who drinks whatever it is, 20 drinks per week. What you then do is you create a scary number and you say there's a 70% increase in risk for people who drink 20 drinks a week. When Joe or Jane Public is looking at that, they think in their mind it's 70%. To them, they are automatically thinking, they're not thinking it's a 70% increase in risk. They're thinking it's a 70% chance of getting cancer. Yeah. That's what they think because they see the 70%. In fact, what they've done is something terribly misleading because the chance of getting that form of cancer was minuscule to start with. And the 70% increase in risk, you might be going from 0.2% to 0.26% or some tiny, tiny amount.
So still small.
Yeah.
Still
it's
small.
Tiny. But they phrase it in a way that they're trying to scare people. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is one of the problems that I have with this sort of new and more pervasive public health approach is there seems to be a willingness to not tell the truth or to deliberately misrepresent information if you think that will accomplish your policy objective. So if you think you're going to save lives, or if you think you're going to reduce the incidence of a health disease or outcome, then you suddenly decide that it's okay to not tell the truth and to not present people with useful or accurate information. And I think that that is fundamentally wrong. I think it completely erodes faith in public health guidance. And I think that governments should actively be trying to stop this sort of approach to public health.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things from that. Thank you. Just coming back to the science part, you know, if the foundation of making statements and findings on a basis that you scientifically cannot do, then even doing the calculation of increased risk would be something you'd need to be able to comb through again, right? But back to the policy part, you know, what's underpinning this? And, you know, what do we trust? And a policy that applies to all of us. And I think I remember a while ago we chatted about, I think, what was the success of the more, I guess we'll say, the existing guidelines that haven't been changed. And, you know, leading up to the last few decades, more of a message and an education around moderate drinking. And in fact, that public policy was effective in broad terms in Canada. And that was working, apparently, right? As a policy and letting the people be the people and being able to choose within the, you know, moderate guidelines. And that was working. So, you know, why, you know, maybe you might comment on that and then we can get through to the objectives of the proponents of, you know, the anti-alcohol movement.
Yeah, it was working. The old guidelines were, in my view, relatively sensible. They, you know, had some basis behind them. And in fact, the sort of more dangerous forms of drinking, underage drinking, binge drinking, those sorts of problem drinking behaviors had all been in decline in Canada and actually in most places around the world for quite some time. So to me, there's a problem with jettisoning actually an effective and more sensible approach and then adopting an approach which I think is very ridiculous, to be perfectly honest, and has very little scientific basis to it. I think what will happen is people will just tune out the message completely, and particularly people who perhaps were more prone to problem drinking. They'll just say, I'm not going to listen to this messaging at all because it's so ridiculous. And I think at a very base level, it is ridiculous because mm-hmm. you look back, over in recent history, and for hundreds, actually thousands of years, people have been drinking, wine in moderation with dinner. If these people were right, that there was no safe level of alcohol consumption, then there would have been, they would have all of those people would have been stricken with all these terrible diseases. I know tons of people, my friends, my family, who have drunk in moderation for their entire lives, and they were not stricken with mm-hmm. terrible health outcomes because of their having a wine with dinner, or mm-hmm. my dad who had a scotch, at the end of the day. This mm-hmm. is just fundamentally nonsense when you think about it, because you just know on a base level there is something terribly wrong with the conclusions. When you look at the world at large, and when you look at your friends and family, you know that when they're telling you that there's no safe level of alcohol consumption, that's just fundamentally wrong. It's just incorrect information that they're disseminating, and they're doing it because they want to scare people. That's why they're doing that.
Yeah. So let's get into the next point of your series, which is about, the objectives and what is driving this, what I'll call a resurgence of a prohibitionist movement to basically outlaw alcohol, and by saying that there is no safe amount of alcohol consumption. And that has caught the ear of the WHO, which, for a lack of better words and to use some plain speak, has set up an office or department, to look at this question, as a kind of a global health concern. And you wonder, well, wow, what is driving that? Why is this happening? So, in addition to around the questionability of the scientific veracity of the claims, which we've gone through in broad terms, your second part of your series is, don't listen to biased sources. We should be listening to neutral science and not advocates. So maybe I'll touch a little bit about what's driving. It seems to me a temperance movement, for lack of better words. But when there are advocates, there's funding and there is, there's support and energy. So, is this a handful of groups that now are picking up steam, or, in broad terms, where is this coming from? Or is that too simplistic a question?
No, it's not. It's a good question. There have always, throughout history, been people who have been opposed to alcohol consumption and opposed to all kinds of different things for certain reasons. And quite often, those people are, have moral or religious objections to consumption of certain products, particularly alcohol has been one of them. And that was the basis for prohibition. There was a very strong temperance movement at the time, which was mostly religiously driven, to outlaw alcohol consumption entirely, and they were successful in North America for a certain period of time. And I think nowadays we're seeing two main groups that are opposed to alcohol consumption. The first group is the public health group, which I think is doing so on the basis of the nanny state kind of interventions that I mentioned earlier. I think mostly those people are well-intentioned, but I think, as I said, sometimes they have a propensity to not tell the truth if they think that will accomplish their policy objectives. And I don't think that's a good approach to public health at all. And I think it is currently eroding people's faith in public health advice. So I think that part of it is probably the slightly better part of it. But there's also a significant group of people who really are anti-alcohol academics. And that group of people and there's, you know, a fair number of them are in various places around the world, including in Canada. They built careers on anti-alcohol advocacy. Their funding comes mostly from government, so mostly from taxpayers like you and I. And it's sort of a vicious circle because you need to generate more and more studies in order to get more and more funding. And so, you know, the institute or the department that you work for at your academic institution needs to keep churning out these anti-alcohol studies and these anti-alcohol papers in order to get more research funding and to justify the funding for your department. And this has sort of become, I think, quite a problem because you end up with people who they are ideologically biased, I think, because the only way their entire salaries and entire funding comes from anti-alcohol work. So unless you can perpetuate that, you're out of work and you've got to go back to, you know, being a social sciences professor, which is, you know, the case for some of them. And, you know, you are looking at situations where people have to keep doing that in order to maintain their academic credentials, even when the evidence is pretty thin, and when you're making conclusions that you shouldn't be making from the basis of the science. Some of those people as well, which I think is probably the most disturbing part of it, some of these people have long-standing connections and have worked with temperance organizations. There's a very well-funded temperance organization that's based in Sweden. It used to be called the International Order of Good Templars, or the Independent Order of Good Templars, which goes right back to Prohibition time. That's when it was formed. It was a religious organization that advocated for prohibition and was successful in doing that at one point. And that organization opened up branches around the world. And the name sounded like something out of a, you know, Dan Brown
book.
So they changed the name, and now it's called Movendi, which is sort of an innocuous sounding name. But it is still an organization that's an avowed temperance organization. In order to become a member of that organization, you have to pledge lifetime abstinence from alcohol. Some of the people who were involved in the CCSA report and who have been very active on this file have worked extensively and closely with Movendi for many years. In fact, if you look at Movendi's website, you'll see that I think every single scientific study that Movendi has produced in the last 10 years was co-authored by some of the people from the CCSA. So, you know, you have to start to wonder about the motivations of those people and the fact that they have closely aligned themselves with a group that's avowedly anti-alcohol. You know, I said it's kind of like asking your vegan cousin to organize the food choices for the family picnic. You shouldn't be surprised when there's no meat option. If you have asked somebody in academia to come up with recommendations and that person has been working with anti-alcohol organizations for their entire career, don't be surprised if the results of the study are against alcohol, because that's just what they're about. If you asked, and there's lots of neutral scientists out there who do studies which I think are not biased, and those studies still show the same thing. They still show that the moderate consumption of alcohol is fine, or actually has some minor health benefits in certain cases. You know, the studies that I think are that have been flooding the media are the ones that are produced by people who have an axe to grind against alcohol. And I think, unfortunately, they've been sort of getting their place in the sun lately. And I think people should really question who they're listening to. is the person who's making the recommendations part of one of these anti-alcohol groups? If they are, then I don't think you should be listening to them. I think you should be listening to somebody who's a lot more sensible. There are people from Harvard. There are people from Stanford. There are people from very reputable organizations all around the world who have made much more sensible analysis of these issues. And I think you should people should seek those out and pay attention to them. There was a great article by Dr. Laura Catena, whose family actually makes wine, but she's also a physician. She worked in San Francisco as an emergency room physician for many years. She wrote a great article about this issue, these issues. And if you look up her article, I think it's an excellent analysis of what's been going on and who you should listen to and who you shouldn't.
I agree on those points, and I'll make a note in the episode notes about that article by Dr. Catena. I think it is excellent, and a person who is, you know, multi-generation winemaking family in Argentina, Stanford-trained doctor, has worked in the ER, and from altitude sees, you know, the historic connection of having a glass of wine and life and family. And then also her, you know, scientific trained background. So I think that's an excellent suggestion. I'll put a couple of other things in the notes for people should they like to read some other pieces that you suggest. I mean, there's a lot there. One thing just you touched on, you know, these messages getting some time in the sun. And I'm just thinking about right now in the United States, people are anticipating that the next set of or updated dietary guidelines and alcohol guidelines will be released in the first quarter of 2025, they think. You know, I think there was a lot of discussion in the United States with lawmakers and what was going to be considered as part of that analysis in light of these messages. And people are looking to the CCSA report outside of our country is to, in some ways, they're talking about it as the Canadian guidelines and whether to adopt the two drinks a week. There's a lot here. I mean, I know I've read a commentary about depending if Robert Kennedy Jr. becomes the health person and how that may affect things. I don't know. But, you know, so time will tell, but that's quite interesting space to watch with what's going on in the US and if they're going to be adopting things from the CCSA report. I don't know. Do you have any views or predictions on that, or we're going to wait and see, you know, well, what happens south of the border coming from, you know, the fact that people are looking at paper that's been penned up here?
Well, my message to people in the US who might be listening and who are interested in this issue is you should really fundamentally look at who was behind the CCSA report and look at the science, because it is my strong belief that the science is not justifiable and that the people who are behind that report, many of them are biased and they shouldn't have been making the recommendations that they did, and they certainly shouldn't have been using the language and jumping to some of the conclusions that they did in that report. I think that anybody who's looking at that in the US for guidance should be aware that, be very aware that that report has received a lot of criticism and has not been accepted by Health Canada. They are not the federal guidelines in Canada. So, you know, I think that what people should look at in the United States is there's also been a process in the US which has been questionable in terms of who's been included and who hasn't. And there's, in fact, some of the people who are behind the CCSA report, people working in Canada, are part of the advisory group in the United States, which to me is quite bizarre. Mm-hmm. Why do you have Canadians on that panel? You know, you've got some of the leading academic institutions in the world in the United States. Why are you asking Canadians to come onto that panel and provide advice, particularly when some of those same people produced a report which has not been accepted by the federal Canadian government and which, in my view, has some serious fundamental scientific problems with it? So I think that hopefully the United States will not go down the same path that Canada has gone down, and they will be more rigorous in their analysis of the science, and they will be more sensible too in terms of looking at everything and figuring out, don't listen to people who have got an axe to grind. You know, to only make conclusions and recommendations based on solid science. Don't do it on, you know, shoddy work.
So I wonder then if this comes into the point about make your decisions, get a balanced view, consider the source of your information. I mean, this would be almost with anything in life. And without any spoiler alerts, you haven't released your final part of your three-part series of your blog series. I think it's called Individuals Should Make Their Own Choices. Yeah. Do you want to give us a bit of a sneak peek on what we can expect you to say in that piece?
Sure. Fundamentally, I think that these sorts of sweeping guidelines, while they can be a little bit useful, fundamentally, people need to make their own decisions and they need to make their own choices based on their own personal circumstances. I think that the conclusion of no amount of alcohol is safe is ridiculous because, as I said earlier, everybody has different levels of health. Everybody has different exercise habits. Everybody has different genetic predispositions to certain diseases or health outcomes. And it could well be that if you look at your genetic background or if you look at your lifestyle, you might decide, oh, I don't want to drink at all because I've got all these other risk factors, and maybe I don't want to add that in there. But the fundamental truth behind, for example, the causes of cancer, which is what the anti-alcohol people are really focusing on and trying to scare people that they're going to get cancer. The fundamental truth with respect to cancer is alcohol causes a tiny, tiny number of cancers. It's like 5% or less of cancers are caused by alcohol. So if somebody was to think, well, if I stop drinking, I'm going to eliminate my cancer risk, that's just patently untrue. It has nothing to do with that. But what people should do is look at their own risk. If you have a history of cancer in your family, then maybe you should be thinking more seriously about the amount of alcohol that you consume. But if you're fundamentally a healthy person, if you have a pretty good health, if you exercise, if your diet is good, there is absolutely no reason why you shouldn't be able to incorporate wine with your dinner or beer while you're watching a hockey game. There is nothing wrong with that. And those sorts of choices you need to make yourself. You need to decide. Wine may give you a lot of pleasure. It may, make you happy with your friends. Your family may have drunk wine for generations and generations, and it's just part of who you are. So for public health people or for government to come out with sweeping statements like no level of alcohol consumption is safe is ridiculous because it's just not true for the vast majority of people to say that.
So thank you so much for closing out with that very positive note, because we've talked about a lot of things that I think bring some doom and gloom to some minds of people who enjoy wine and are scared to continue to have it as part of their life in moderation and with their dinner and their meals. And, for centuries now and thousands of years, fermented drinks have been made by humans for the ritual and to connect and to be in the world of the senses. So thank you for reminding us of that importance. And I look forward to seeing you sometime before the end of the year in person so we can clink glasses, hopefully with some lovely Pinot Noir or Chardonnay in the glass. So thank you for joining me today. As always, I really appreciate and value your the way you elucidate and clearly set out policy and what's going on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya. My pleasure.
Thank you for tuning into my show with Mark Hicken today. I hope that you found our discussion informative
and helpful as you navigate current discussions swirling all around us regarding alcohol consumption. I'd like to reiterate here that this episode is focused on public policy relating to alcohol consumption and how such policy is developed, and the work and/or knowledge upon which that policy is based. Our discussion is focused on the grounds upon which anti-alcohol advocates claim that there is no safe amount of alcohol consumption, and our discussion as to whether that is appropriate or correct, and to be incorporated into policy which governs our choice as to whether we, as individuals, elect to consume alcohol, and, for example, have wine on our tables. If you'd like to follow Mark's commentary further, look for him on LinkedIn or on his website, winelaw.ca. I'll drop that into our show notes, together with some references as to other articles and experts who Mark and I discuss in the show. If you have friends, family, or colleagues who are interested in these topics or issues, please share this episode with them. I'm working on my next episode now and look forward to seeing you back here again soon on the TT Wine Explorer podcast. Until then, take care.